Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this fourth Ordinary General Meeting of the session. Copies of the minutes of the Ordinary General Meeting held on 24th January have been displayed on the Institute Notice Board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Nobody disagrees. Thank you. I'd like to start by extending a particular welcome to our guests here tonight. We have Peter Clark, Senior Project Manager for Insurance International Accounting Standards Board, Peter Vipond, Head of Financial Regulation and Taxation of the ABI, John Breckenridge, Policy Advisor, Financial Regulation and Taxation from the ABI, Ray King, Group Finance Director of Bupa, John Heal, Group Actuary, ING Group, Rob Proctor, Head of European Insurance Research at Morgan Stanley, Roger Hill of UBS Limited. And also, I'd like to extend a welcome to any other guests and personal guests and members here tonight. You are most welcome, and please feel free to join in our discussion later. Before we start the meeting, we have a number of prizes to present. The first one are two prizes for the McKinsey Prize for Communications awarded to the best performing student in Subject 201, the communications paper. The award of this prize has been made possible by McKinsey & Company offering to provide sponsorship to the profession. In addition to providing the prize, McKinsey's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession. And we have two prize winners tonight. For the April 2004 examinations, Andrew Hull, and for the September 2004 examinations, Spencer Adams. So if Andrew would like to come forward, I'll come round and present you. Well done, both of you. We need good communicators in the actuarial profession. The second set of prizes are Worshipful Company of Actuaries prizes, and I'd like to invite the Master of the Worshipful Company of Actuaries, Alan Frost, to say a few words and present the prizes. Alan.
Thank you very much indeed, President. I've taken the caution of already having done the first one, so we won't be doing that. Before I present the prizes, I'd just like to say a few words for those of you who weren't at the meeting in January. The Worshipful Company has three prime functions. The first is to promote what actuaries are within the city, and as master, all sorts of events, I often find myself explaining what an actuary is. I hope that it's helpful to the profession, as the profession itself tries to find its way after the Morris Report. So that's our first function. The second function, delivery meant in the city, is to be involved in the corporate governance of the city itself, and we vote for the sheriffs, and we vote for the Lord Mayor, and one or two other things, and that's very important to us. There are 107 livery companies, we are the 91st corporate presidents. The third thing we do, and the thing that probably takes up most of our time, is charitable work. We have a charitable trust which disperses about £60,000 each year. And as part of our work, which is very heavily geared towards education, we obviously assist the Institute with these prizes. I've got two prizes to present tonight, both are from the the September Diet in alphabetical order. The first is to mark Daniel for his outstanding performance in the pension examination. Mark. And the second prize, which is for her performance in the life examination, Helen Pellett.
Thank you, Alan. We now proceed to the main part of the business this evening. Presentation of a paper entitled Current Developments in Embedded Value Reporting by a working party chaired by Pat O'Keefe and comprising Amish Desai, Cameron Farugi, Gary Hibbert, Alan Maxwell, Sandy Sharp, Neil Taverner, Mike Ward and Fraser Willis. And I'll ask Cameron Farugi, please, to introduce the paper.
Thank you, President. Embedded value reporting is undergoing rapid and significant change. Up to now, it has broadly followed the principles outlined in Anderson's 1959 paper, where one discount rate is applied to surpluses arising from a projection of best estimate cash flows. This discount rate is theoretically based on shareholders' required return, given the risks in the business, and may be set using the top-down weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, approach, as described in Brealey and Myers. Up to now, embedded value disclosure practice has broadly followed Pearl's 1989 appraisal value report issued in its defence of the hostile takeover by AMP. In recent years, we have seen various enhancements both to embedded value methodology and to disclosure practice. These enhancements address some well-rehearsed weaknesses which we set out in section 1.2 of the paper. In 2003, AMP and Royal & Sun Alliance published market-consistent embedded values, or MCEV, where the discounting evaluation of options followed a different bottom-up approach described in section B9, page 52 of the paper, and the cost of capital adjustment represented an allowance for some of the frictional costs described in section B258, page 45. With these developments as background, in May 2004, the CFO Forum published the European Embedded Value Principles and Basis for Conclusions. The CFO Forum's 19 members have committed to publishing any supplementary information under this EEV basis from May 2005 onwards, although earlier adoption is encouraged. The CFO Forum has kindly permitted us to reproduce the EEV principles in Appendix A of this paper, pages 31 to 41. This working party recognises the considerable achievement of the CFO Forum, not least in getting so many major insurers to sign up to this common basis. We set out our views of EEV in Chapter 5 of this paper, in particular the areas which represent a significant step forward. So how are the EEV principles being implemented in practice? Well, some companies, such as Aegon, stated publicly that they were already broadly compliant. But after we finalised our paper, two insurers published fully compliant EEV results. On the 13th of January of this year, Aviva published restated end 2003 and mid-2004 results, and on the 17th of February, ING published end 2004 results. And we thought it would be interesting to compare and contrast the key features of these publications, although it is clearly too early to extrapolate to other companies. First, the similarities. Both Aviva and ING published a detailed analysis of movement, split into value of in-force and net worth. Both published a set of remarkably similar sensitivities to both the embedded value and value of new business, possibly a template for the industry, consistency in the industry going forwards. Both Aviva and ING used the top-down WACC approach to set the discount rate, not the bottom-up MCEV approach. The risk margin did not generally vary by country or product line. Both Aviva and ING used stochastic real-world models to assess the time value of options and guarantees using the WACC discount rate and did not use market-consistent models. Both Aviva and ING used internal risk-based capital models to work out the cost of capital, which resulted in significant differentiation by country and product line. For example, Aviva applied the cost of capital to 200% of the regulatory minimum for its UK annuity business and 100% for the rest of its UK business. And finally, both Aviva and ING made an explicit deduction for their pension scheme deficits and increased expense assumptions in the light of EEV Principle 9. And now for a couple of differences. Aviva based projected new money risk-free rates on government yield curves. ING, on the other hand, based new money rates on the views of its economics department, which took government yield curves as a starting point, but made some adjustments, particularly an increase in Asia to allow for its views on how China would lead the region to prosperous growth. Aviva reduced the WACC discount rate by 10 basis points to allow for risks valued explicitly elsewhere. ING deliberately did not make such an adjustment, but it estimated that an adjustment would be of the order of 30 basis points to allow external users to reduce the discount rate should they so choose. It is credit to the disclosure of both companies that differences such as these can be identified. The EEV principles clearly leave considerable room for manoeuvre in interpretation, subject to the requirements for disclosure. Whether it is the two differences above or more fundamental differences, such as using either the top-down WACC or bottom-up MCEV approaches to set the discount rate and allow for options and guarantees. In section 4.8 of this paper, we set out three key questions practitioners face when they come to implement these principles. First, what framework should we use to measure market and credit risk? Second, what allowance should be made in the valuation for diversifiable risk? And third, where should the allowance for risk be made in the valuation? And in section 8 of this paper, we use these questions to stimulate discussion of our conclusions. What we look forward to this evening is hearing what you think. Thank you.
I now ask Nick Walker to open the discussion.
Good evening. I'd like to start by thanking the authors for a valuable summary of the state of embedded value reporting as it stands at the moment. The paper covers wide ground, and I'm sure it's proved and will continue to prove useful to both practitioners and beginners to the subject alike. This is a timely paper, coming as it does at a time when some companies are just starting to publish information under the CFO Forum principles on European embedded values. And others are also considering, and in some cases have published, information on a market-consistent EV basis. As the authors point out in their first section, companies are currently making the choice between moving forwards on a European EV basis, which uses real-world economic assumptions and generally a single risk discount rate, and which is really an extension of traditional methodologies, or on a market-consistent basis, or even on both. In fact, as we see in the paper, European embedded values and market-consistent embedded values are not completely distinct. It's possible to use market-consistent techniques to set some of the market-related assumptions within a European EV framework, and it is the view of at least some camps that a form of market-consistent EV reporting is allowable under the CFO principles on European EV reporting, as well as the real-world single discount rate approach. I think this is an area where the industry needs to take some care. It'll not be helpful to users of information to have companies reporting under two seemingly distinct embedded value methodologies. In section 2.3, the authors discuss the issues with traditional EV reporting. And in relation to the cost of capital, one might add the relative crudeness of the calculation under traditional reporting, and the fact that the cost is dependent on the asset mix deemed to back the capital, with a lower cost, generally resulting from a riskier asset mix. The ways in which the European and market-consistent EV methodologies address the areas of concern in traditional reporting are then discussed in various places throughout the paper. In section 3, the authors discuss whether the embedded value, suitably adjusted, should drive the market capitalisation, or vice versa. As the authors point out in section 3.11, some companies are now explicitly using the historic market capitalisation, as reflected in the beta of the shares, to help set the risk discount rate. This would certainly seem to address some of the concerns over the subjectivity of the discount rate setting process, although I would add that if this method is used, it still needs to be demonstrated that the risks to the shareholders' cash flows are adequately and consistently reflected elsewhere in the basis, which is not a trivial task. In particular, it's not immediately clear to me how companies adopting this approach within a European EV framework, combined with a non-market consistent methodology for setting economic assumptions, will ensure that a change in asset mix will not lead to a spurious change in embedded value, which of course was one of the criticisms of the traditional methodology. Also, when setting the discount rate in this manner, consideration then needs to be given to what adjustments need to be made within the discount rate, or elsewhere, to reflect the fact that using the unadjusted beta of the shares of a group transacting more than just long-term insurance, and that is open to new business, is unlikely to be completely appropriate in setting the discount rate for enforced long-term insurance business. Such adjustments are likely to be subjective, potentially leaving scope for criticism. In section 4 on allowances for risk, section 4.3 introduces the concept of systematic and non-systematic risk and starts the discussion of how these should be treated in embedded value reporting. As the authors state, financial theory suggests that the market will not reward the taking on of non-systematic or diversifiable risk beyond an allowance for frictional costs. This highlights one of the main areas of debate for market-consistent EV reporting, in particular, as to whether it really is sufficient to allow for non-systematic risks solely through frictional costs, and, even if it is, what the level of frictional costs should be. In section 5, the authors talk through some of the considerations arising from the European EV principles issued by the CFO Forum. As the authors state in section 5.2, it's one of the aims of the CFO principles to bring greater comparability and consistency to published embedded value information. This is a challenge for the industry given the wide scope for interpretation within the principles. While the principles' drive for greater disclosure will be applauded by users of the information, the devil may still be in the detail. For example, how transparent will the impact of different companies' approaches to management actions within the value of guarantees be? Remaining with the value of guarantees for a moment, the authors raise the possibility of benchmarking a non-market-consistent value of guarantees against a market-consistent one. If companies do this, it's then useful to ask what a company should do if the market-consistent value is much larger. If such a difference is not reflected elsewhere in the basis, is a small allowance for the time value of guarantees really that much better than no allowance, where the market believes the allowance should be much higher? Section 5.3.4 discusses the setting of non-economic assumptions, with some focus on the treatment of one-off expenses. The suggestion to link the definition of one-off expenses back to the underlying expense drivers and consider whether those drivers are indeed one-off in nature is a valid one. In common with other areas of CFO guidance, the approach allowed is flexible, but with a requirement to disclose what has been done. In 5.3.4.1, the authors appear to call for full disclosure of non-economic bases used, although the CFO guidance on disclosure requires only key economic assumptions to be disclosed, along with the approach taken to determining these and other assumptions. Companies have not, so far, tended to disclose non-economic assumptions within an EV context. In Section 6 and Appendix B, the authors discuss market-consistent EV calculations. As the list in Section 6.1 indicates, there are a number of areas to consider when implementing a market-consistent EV framework. And due to the relative infancy of market-consistent EV reporting, an established methodology has not yet emerged in the market on all of these areas. Nevertheless, as the authors point out in 6.7, market-consistent EV reporting addresses some of the criticisms that have been levelled at traditional reporting, in that it allows a less subjective discount rate calculation and a market-consistent value of financial options and guarantees, as well as the possibility of a more explicit cost of capital calculation via frictional costs. However, frictional cost calculations are one of the areas where an established methodology is yet to emerge. And one view of the current state of market-consistent EV methodology might be that subjectivity within the basis has moved from the risk discount rate, where it lay under traditional methods, to the definition of frictional costs. Appendix B offers a very useful description of the items that need to be considered when developing a market-consistent EV framework, and is reflective of the fact that established methodologies are yet to emerge in some areas of definition. In Section 7, the authors discuss the development of embedded value disclosure in the UK through the 1990s and into the early 2000s, and the general convergence of methodologies over this time, culminating in the publication of the ABI guidance on achieved profits reporting in 2001. Nonetheless, as the authors point out in 7.2.2, the quality and extent of disclosure still varies widely. The CFO principles and guidance offer companies the opportunity to have another look at their disclosures and may therefore drive more consistency in the UK and hopefully across Europe as well in this area. I see one of the major potential advantages of the CFO framework as being increased detail of embedded value disclosure in respect of major European life operations in particular. In conclusion, I'd agree with the authors that the development of the European EV principles represents a significant step forward, but with the potential drawback that they still leave considerable room for manoeuvre. I'd also agree with the authors that market-consistent reporting in itself can provide a more objective solution to some of the areas of subjectivity allowed under European EV reporting, but it does open up other areas of debate. Clearly, embedded values will continue to tax actuaries' minds for some time into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Right, the discussion is now open to the floor. I have been notified of a number of people who've said they wish to contribute to the discussion, but it would be helpful if I could just have a quick show of hands from anybody here who is planning to say something this evening. Could I just... Right, thank you very much. Okay. The meeting will be recorded as normal, but please don't let that deter you from contributing. All speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments before they're published in the journal. If time should not permit you to make your full comments, then you're very welcome to submit these in writing after the meeting, and they again will be published. I believe we have a roving microphone or two, if anybody would prefer to use that rather than coming up to the lectern at the front. Could I finally ask you to state your name clearly before speaking? I'll start with some of the people on my list, and could I invite Peter Wright?
Say who the next one is.
And after Peter, Tim Sheldon.
Thank you, Mr. President. The name is still Peter Wright. I am a supporter of the conceptual framework of MCEV, but I would like to make some comments on what I will term agency cost and the related issue of diversifiable risk, in part emphasising points made by the previous speaker. Agency costs for this purpose includes costs of financial distress, but does not refer to other frictional costs. On these other costs, I was particularly pleased to see a reference to the cost of double investment expenses, which are frequently ignored in traditional embedded value calculations, along, I may say, with any corporate governance costs charged directly to the shareholders' accounts. Clearly, both of these costs should be allowed for. I was, reading the paper, somewhat confused by whether or not the authors were of the collective view that margins should be incorporated into the EV basis in respect to persistency, insurance and expense risks, which are diversifiable by an ultimate investor. This is an important debate within the IASB on phase two of its insurance project and clearly covers general insurance as well as long-term business. The paper seems to conclude that in theory, all that is necessary is for a capital haircut to be taken in respect of agency costs, and this will automatically do the trick for diversifiable risks. However, the paper also suggests that further work is needed in the area of agency costs, and for the time being, it suggested that MCEV could be presented without incorporating these costs, but with suitable sensitivities provided to enable users of the information to formulate their own adjustments. This seems very unsatisfactory, and the profession needs to come up with something more concrete if we are not to avoid the charge that we have simply replaced one subjective area of the calculation of embedded value with another. Is agency cost the new risk discount rate? The paper correctly draws attention in 3.7 to perceived shortfalls in the IASB's current thinking on fair value, to which I would add the deposit floor. It was pleasing to see that our own ASB backed away from implementing these restrictions in FRS 27. However, the problem has not gone away and could be more important than many people think, as the ASB, although no longer the standard setter for listed companies, has the power to prohibit or insist on modifications to the publication of supplementary accounting information such as MCEV and or EEV. I can well see that the ASB may use this power if the industry and the actuarial and accounting professions do not come up with a sound theoretical approach to embedded value reporting. I'm afraid that reporting embedded values which are known to be too high and relying on sensitivities in notes is unlikely to impress the accounting regulators in the longer term, particularly when they believe that the primary accounts are already on a fair value basis. I'd like to conclude by stressing that I'm sold on the basis that agency cost is a better theoretical approach to costing diversifiable risk than alternatives based on market value margins or risk discount rates. However, deriving the agency cost for this purpose is not going to be easy. Thank you.
I should have said that in view of the number of speakers, we'd like to keep contributions down to 3 or 4 minutes, and we do have a system of warning lights for the speakers. So thank you, Peter, for sticking to that time limit without even being asked. After Tim Sheldon, and then after that, Paul Collins.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, the closing sentence or the first paragraph of the paper, talking of the actuary's dilemma, begs two related questions. First, whose assessment of risk are we talking about? And secondly, why is it the actuary's dilemma rather than anyone else's? why, when market prices are available, would we not want to calibrate to those market prices, preferring some subjective measure of risk? And how many people would knowingly vote for a market-inconsistent method? Is the choice of method the actuaries, or perhaps more pertinently, the actuarial profession's problem? Two major criticisms of the interim Morris review are that we don't work closely enough with other professions and that we need better standards. When EVs are used for public reporting, the choice of method is not solely the actuaries. There are accounting and commercial considerations as well. However, where we are advising clients as actuaries on value for other purposes, then the profession may be able to recommend a particular approach and endorse this in appropriate standards. That should not, of course, prevent us from acting in accordance with a client's instructions to use a different approach, but robust standards would enhance the concept of a market-consistent EV. The work of the CFO Forum in developing the EEV principles is undoubtedly of great value in promoting better standards and disclosure across the European insurance industry. The principles allow considerable scope in the choice of methods and assumptions, particularly in respect of options and guarantees. Whether disclosure will be sufficient to enable comparisons to be made between companies using different methods remains to be seen. The principles do, though, seem to permit the use of a market-consistent approach should a company wish to do so. In the UK, where we now have market-consistent reporting of with-profits liabilities, consistency with that reporting regime would seem desirable. The working party considers the question of how allowance should be made for diversifiable risks. The EEV principles follow the traditional EV approach of making such allowance in the discount rate, and therefore make little attempt to progress this tricky problem. Financial theory provides us with a framework of frictional costs, but this theory applies at the level of the total value of a company, whereas EV focuses on just part of that total value. There is therefore an arbitrary decision to be made for accounting purposes as to which frictional costs, if any, should be included in financial statements. For example, it would be inconsistent to allow for that part of financial distress costs related to the loss of franchise value in an embedded value calculation, since goodwill or the value of future new business is excluded. As frictional costs affect shareholder value and are not a liability to a third party, there is an argument that they should be excluded from accounting statements. Full allowance for company taxation and investment management expenses on all assets should they be made, since these are liabilities to third parties. If certain frictional costs are to be included, it would be helpful if they could be disclosed separately. It is, though, necessary to allow for frictional costs when pricing, and consequently valuations for internal purposes would benefit from their inclusion, hard though it may be in practice to make accurate allowance for these costs. I agree with the author's overall conclusion that market consistency provides a solid foundation to valuation and that it is a useful check against other more subjective measures. Thank you.
Paul Collins and then Chris Johnson.
Yes, Paul Collins. I'd like to thank the presenters and the writers of this report for a very useful and interesting summary of the current developments in embedded value reporting. I'd like to make some comments in two areas. Firstly, some general comments on issues raised within the paper, and secondly, some thoughts on next steps for the profession on embedded values. Firstly, some comments on the paper. Although overall the paper does give a balanced summary of the different embedded value techniques currently available, it does propose the MCEV framework as a way forward. It is true that MCEV does have many theoretical attractions, but as the paper notes, its inability to deal with non-market risk in a robust way is a significant disadvantage. Market consistency is an important tool for measuring the performance of short-term market trading books, but it is still not clear that it is the right tool for managing and reporting the performance of a long-term insurance company. An approach used under the European Embedded Value Framework, for example by Aviva and ING, has been to take the weighted average cost of capital as an overall view on risk and then adjust it in an open and transparent way to allow for risks already allowed for elsewhere in the calculation. I believe that the CFO Forum's development of the EEV principles has been a very large step forward and has been well received by the investment community. It will certainly be instructive to gather views from users of accounts on the relative merits of the EEV and MCV approaches. It's important that we do work with any industry consensus as it develops, and I think actuaries must be careful to be seen to be working with the insurance industry rather than against it as it develops its thinking. Now some thoughts on next steps for the profession. In my view, detailed UK professional guidance on embedded value reporting is not required. In particular, this could put UK companies at a competitive disadvantage compared to European insurers. However, some further guidance on applying embedded value techniques to UK-specific products, such as with-profits funds, would be appropriate and welcome. The profession should work with standard setters to ensure that embedded value reporting is robust and technically accurate. For example, the ABI's working party, which is currently thinking of updating the Chief Office Guidance Note, would be one area where we could work together. And certainly a lot of the challenges around embedded value reporting apply both to EEV and to MCV approaches. Finally, we should consider the links to International Financial Reporting Standards, IFRS. I understand, although Peter Clarke may have his own thoughts to give, that value-based measures such as embedded values are not particularly popular with the IASB as a form of primary reporting. But they are used by life insurers to price and manage their business and are of immense value to investors, and hence they should be permitted within the IFRS framework, either as notes to the accounts or as some form of supplementary disclosure.
Chris Johnson and then John Heal.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I too would like to thank the authors for a clear and very useful summary of the current embedded value reporting terrain. Their paper provides an important focus for discussion about the direction in which we should move in future. First from me, a detail point, which is simply to underscore that companies do not increase value by loading up on asset risk. This is a clear consequence of a market-consistent treatment, but it's worth stressing, as too often in the past, companies have taken higher asset risk as an intended solution to financial difficulties, and they've paid a price for doing so. As actuaries and managers, we need to be careful to give careful counsel to others about increasing the financial bet in this way. Moving on, I'd next like to comment briefly on where the profession should head, in my view, on the issue of value assessment and management in the future. To begin with, we should recognise that over the last few years, the profession has upskilled itself enormously in the application of financial economics techniques, albeit that there is still some way to go on the training front for all of us. With the advent of MCEV as a development of those techniques, we have a way to powerfully link independent current market asset pricing to our businesses and to throw important light on the links between risk, value and capital, whilst addressing the valuation of options and guarantees and the selection of risk discount rates along the way. Clearly, there are some issues which need further work, but in my view, we're well on the way to the best financial measurement and management tool that we've ever had available to us. The CFO's Forum's work on EEV also represents a huge step forward, and it's good to see our industry acting very much together for once. As the authors note, there are different ways of implementing EEV, but it seems fair to say that the best use of the framework will be made if we take a market-consistent interpretation. I don't agree with everything the FSA has done or is doing, but it has led us correctly with its focus on realistic balance sheets, risk and individual capital assessment. They are further important moves in the right direction. So, given all of those developments, I believe strongly that the profession now needs communally to get behind the use of MCEV as a core part of financial management. MCEV sheds many insights on the nature and situation of our business, and it provides what is perhaps our best and most comprehensive view of the economic capital of insurance enterprises. I also believe that the techniques should be applied to funded pension schemes. There, much more light needs to be shed on the issues of risk and capital in the schemes and their interaction with risk and capital in sponsoring firms. This is an area where neither actuaries nor shareholders, trustees, rating agencies and investment analysts have yet properly grasped the nettle. Younger actuaries have played a great part in moving us to where we are today, and I urge them in particular to continue to take us forward and to make market-consistent methodologies central to insurance and pensions business management in the future. Thank you.
John Heal and then Rob Proctor.
John Heal, I would like to first of all thank the Institute for inviting me here today to speak, and would like to thank the authors of this paper, because it will come in very handy. I wish I would have had this last fall as we were going through all the pros and cons of EEV principles around the world. The magnitude of what we did at ING, we have over 700 insurance risk professionals in over 40 business units in 23 countries. And so one of the great results of the EEV principles and of this paper is getting better disclosure and consistency around the world. I would like to keep my remarks short and to the point, and discuss three or four key items. The first of all is, although ING Group did apply the EEV principles in the more traditional way, we did take a step towards a market-consistent approach. We did change our capital model that is used in our EEVs to be calibrated to economic capital. And the way we do economic capital, we do it on a fully market-consistent approach. So we have adjusted our capital to try to reflect risk in a much better way. We did not specifically adjust the discount rates for the risk in a particular product. We used the capital to reflect, and the cost of holding that capital as the way to reflect that risk. The second key thing I'd like to highlight, and we think is very important, is disclosure. Because there are different interpretations to embedded values, whether it be under the traditional way and even as we see under a market-consistent framework, we view disclosure as the key way forward and to always give many sensitivities and throughout the process. I learned just going through this latest publication, we still have a long way to go in terms of communication for the analysts and other users of this information, and we have a long list to improve our future disclosure next year. My last point is on the market-consistent embedded values. We are still looking at that at ING Group. One area that we are toying with and we're doing some studies on is particularly in the whole subject of frictional costs or non-diversifiable risks. Our approach and the way we're trying to look at it right now is to apply our economic capital methodologies, which are consistent with the Solvency II framework, to non-diversifiable risks and apply that capital on a cost of holding the capital. Might not be perfect with regard to frictional costs, but it is a framework that's consistent with Solvency II and other frameworks that I think will be more understandable to the users of the information. Lastly, as an actuary, but also as a former investment banker, I think that the insurance industry does need to get to one system, that allowing two quite different systems long term is just not in the good, is not a good use for the users of all this information. So I really hope the Institute and applaud their leadership in moving forward on this type of approach. Thank you.
Rob Proctor and then David Dalloway.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Rob Proctor. I'm an equity research analyst looking at a wide range of European insurance companies with a view to presenting their relative merits, including, of course, insight into their valuation to a range of institutional investors. As such, I've naturally been encouraged by the CFO Forum's efforts to overcome the well-known and documented issues associated with the traditional embedded value approach, which has already been discussed. However, while it's early days, yet I'm somewhat disappointed with the European embedded value disclosures that we as outsiders have seen to date. If I may cite a couple of examples to illustrate some of the issues. First, and with regards to ING and the previous speaker, and I don't want to be critical because I applaud the fact that ING is up early and has given us, as analysts, this disclosure. I would cite the fact that the EEV data has illustrated, and John alluded to this, the highly capital-intensive nature of the back book of its Asian life operations, while providing little by way of detail on the capital intensity of the Asian new business. Perhaps that's a point that can be addressed with even more disclosure next year, but we will see. Second, in a more general sense, I'm concerned about the use of fixed income new money rate assumptions that are materially above prevailing market rates. It seems not unusual for this assumption to be 100 basis points or more higher than prevailing bond yields in the market, in fact a level that has not actually prevailed for almost 3 years. I would agree that this may be compensated for by the discount rate or elsewhere in the basis, but it could naturally lead to a negative variance, which is clearly difficult to assess from the outside, as well as a lack of confidence perhaps in the work of outsiders such as myself regarding to the extent to which the reported value of options, financial options and guarantees has properly been captured in a market consistent manner. But I don't want to be overly negative, and I recognise that investors and analysts will always demand more information, demands which obviously cannot always be satisfied. But I do think more could be done to ensure at least a more optical consistency of European embedded value disclosures. For example, with regard to the value of options and guarantees, I quote the authors themselves in saying that the principles allow considerable scope in the choice of methodology and assumptions, and it appears unlikely that comparisons between companies will be straightforward. That's pretty unacceptable, I think, as an outside constituent. Insurers want their shares to be better appreciated and valued by a sceptical investor base, and I think they should, looking at the discount they arguably command relative to the broader equity market today. It's therefore crucial, in my view, that the treatment of risk should be able to be readily assessed and, most importantly, simply and quickly compared across different companies by analysts and other outside observers. Thank you very much.
David Dalloway, and then Ed Morgan.
David Dalloway. I'd like to talk briefly about how MCEV and EEV fit together. First, it's worth saying that getting 19 disparate companies to agree on anything at all is quite impressive. Getting them to agree on a new EV standard that even includes an explicit allowance for options is very impressive. Nevertheless, the EEV guidance is at a relatively high level, and companies trying to apply it must work out how to do so. My view, unsurprisingly, is that a market-consistent approach is probably the best way of doing this. Looking at the guidance for a moment, my reading is that, particularly looking at the basis for conclusions, that the risk discount rate used must make a full allowance for all financial risk, and that it should reflect all the available information in the market. This would seem to outlaw the setting of risk discount rates, and I quote, in line with everybody else's, which is probably the most common method of setting them at the moment. And it would appear to be very much in line with the market-consistent approach. Indeed, if one looks at the basis for conclusions, it states the principles that are around setting risk discount rates should be applied so that shifting between asset classes does not have a material impact on the embedded value. I can't think of any approach that isn't market-consistent that achieves that. Looking at the guidance a little further, unfortunately, it seems to perpetuate a type of risk-neutral versus deflator debate, similar to the one the profession got bogged down in a couple of years ago, before we all realised that actually both approaches gave exactly the same answer. In the case of the guidance, it's couched as a risk discount rate versus risk-adjusted cash flow debate, with a long discussion over which is correct. I think we should be clear. Both approaches are mathematically and provably equivalent. A market-consistent valuation using an appropriate risk discount rate will give exactly the same answer as one using a risk-free discount rate and risk-adjusted cash flows. This debate must stop. The basis for conclusions appears to argue, on first sight, against using market-consistent option prices on the grounds that option prices use risk-adjusted cash flows, and therefore there's a disconnect with the approach to looking at the time for the rest of the value of the business. This is one of the reasons the debate must stop. It's a shame that such a mistake is made, because it mars an otherwise excellent document, and I hope it's to be corrected in a later version. For the present, it gives companies and their advisors a very interesting task in deciding quite how to interpret the guidance. Putting this aside, I think the guidance is a very good step forward, and I also think that MCV is a good way of meeting the guidance, as it fully allows for financial risks in a rigorous way, makes maximum use of market information, and should give very good consistency between companies. I know, and it's been mentioned already, that some are concerned that a market-consistent approach does not put a price on some elements of insurance risks, such as diversifiable risk. Without going into any technical arguments, I'd like to make two points. The first is that a top-down CAPM approach doesn't put a price on such risks either, so that isn't a good reason for using a top-down approach rather than a bottom-up approach. The second is that a market-consistent approach can always be adjusted to allow for such risks. It may be that work on a frictional cost basis isn't fully developed yet, but as the paper points out, all of these things should reduce embedded values. It therefore seems unarguable that a market-consistent valuation should form at least an upper bound for any acceptable embedded value. And I think this is a point that companies, their advisors, and particularly their auditors, might ponder quite carefully before going down any other approach. I'd like to finish by thanking the working party for this paper. It does an admirable job, but I think it's now up to the industry and the profession to move it forward. I believe a truly market-consistent embedded value would be a very significant step in the right direction. Equally, I find it hard to see what anything less, offers compared to developments in fair value and prudential reporting. Thank you.
Ed Morgan and then Steve Taylor Gooby.
My name's Ed Morgan. I'd like to thank the authors again for a very interesting paper. I think it's one of these classic debates between two methodologies, which makes for a very interesting debate, and I think it will run for a little bit. I think one of the key issues is the issue of disclosure, and I wanted to make a couple of points about disclosure. The authors of the paper point out that to the extent that a market-consistent model is perceived not yet to fully allow for all risks, the European embedded value should produce a lower value, and I think this is it's quite a key point. If the values are consistent, as the previous speaker said, they should give the same value. If the EEV has also got an element of insurance risk in there, then it should give a lower value. I think one thing that could be done about this in the disclosure is if there were disclosed sensitivities to variations in the risk margins within the risk discount rate and to variations in the equity risk premia and the credit spreads within the projected investment returns, then it would be possible to calibrate those two together to estimate the part of the risk margin in the risk discount rate that is due to market and credit risk. Now, hopefully, this is less than the entire risk margin. If it's not, the EV will be higher than the MCEV. If it is, the EV should be lower than the MCEV, but that would be a very useful bit of information to somebody reading those accounts. Second point is about disclosure on assumptions. I think greater disclosure on assumptions is very useful. I think the CFO forum document takes that process forward to some extent. I think it doesn't give a full disclosure, in my view. I mean, one example is persistency rates. In single premium whole of life business, the long-term persistency rate is very similar to a risk discount rate, and yet the guidance doesn't give any requirement to disclose the long-term persistency rate merely to disclose the method used to get it, particularly in fairly new classes of business like unit-linked business, which has been in existence in some European countries only for a small number of years. The long-term persistency rate is inevitably subjective, and if it's not disclosed, then two alternative subjective approaches to it could give quite a materially different value. I think the paper is very useful and timely. I think the debate needs to go on. It doesn't solve all the questions, but it helps to formulate some of them. And I encourage actuaries to continue to work to resolve these issues.
Steve Taylor-Gooby, and after that, Gareth Collard.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, first let me congratulate the Working Party on a valuable and accurate paper, which gives a great roundup of current developments in the field of embedded value reporting. However, I'd recommend that the Working Party doesn't put their pens away just yet, because this is an area which is developing very rapidly, and it would be good to see a follow-up paper which captures the vast amount of experience that's being accumulated by companies with both of the new methodologies, EEV and MCEV. In my experience, MCEV is maturing rapidly and, if used in a properly controlled way, with appropriate checks on the parameters and assumptions, can be more robust than the paper gives credit for. The paper rightly points out that there are two areas which need further work, namely the appropriate allowance for diversifiable risk and frictional costs. However, despite talk that as to whether or not subjectivity has now moved from a discount rate to frictional costs, it's clear with a bit of analysis the extent to which these allowances are uncertain is relatively immaterial compared with the inaccuracies that can be present in other systems. They do not, therefore, constitute a reason for not moving ahead with MCEV. On the other hand, practical work with the EEV system is showing that, although it is a very major improvement on previous standards, it still needs more development, particularly in the area of setting the correct discount rate. I've seen quite a number of weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, calculations that are currently being used by a number of companies to calculate their discount rates, and it's clear that the method contains a number of areas of judgment. For example, how do you derive a beta? Do you calculate a beta over the last 5 years or the last 6 months? I've seen companies that use both methods, and the answers are very different. And in fact, what we really need is actually an up-to-date forward-looking beta, which can't be calculated. Secondly, how do you pass the beta, i.e. how do you break down the total risk included in the cost of the company's capital between different elements of the business? For example, between life insurance, non-life insurance, and banking. And then how do you pass the beta between the in-force business and the new business? Each of these areas requires quite a lot of judgment, and this gives a great deal of leeway in the selection of a discount rate. And I've seen calculations where the same company could arrive quite honestly at discount rates that are different by up to 250 basis points, which is a very significant margin. Now, this could either be seen as a weakness of the EEV method or a great strength, depending on your standpoint, as it may give respectability to the desired answer. There are considerable dangers in treating the subject too lightly. The metric used for measuring corporate performance and external reporting inevitably becomes suffused throughout other aspects of financial management. And in some, such as pricing, it's very important to be accurate. This brings me to a second issue with the EEV method. Although a WACC analysis can give some guidance on discount rates at a business unit level, it doesn't help in setting the appropriate discount rate to use for pricing or measuring performance of a given product. So far, the only reliable method that I've seen is to carry out an MCEV calculation and back solve to find a discount rate, which rather destroys the point of using another method from MCEV. All in all, I fear that the authors are being a little over-optimistic in the expressed hope that the two methods will converge with time to give the same answers. And without such convergence, I believe the profession should continue to promote the MCEV method as the best available for financial management of long-term business. Thank you.
Gareth Collard and then Penny Coulthard.
Thanks to the authors for a useful review of what's going on. I have remarks in two areas, market consistency, like a few other people, perhaps with an emphasis on credit risk, and also on the use of a formulaic approach to the selection of risk discount rates, something that perhaps we would hope has died, but have a useful example of the bad old days. Common theme about the remarks I've heard earlier, and these remarks, I think, is about disclosure and transparency. And I think that's the most important thing. In the banking world, the regulator effectively ignores interbank credit risk, and balance sheets reflect this. This is somewhat similar to the familiar argument about swap curves and gilts for a balance sheet standard. So what really is market consistent? Analysts, rating agencies, and investors, I think, are the people who are going to drive what actually happens in the marketplace, as one of the speakers earlier said. So we can't impose a methodology that's not acceptable to the market. There is a common benchmark out there in terms of what the regulators are doing. So it's not just the UK regulator that's moving to a fairly robust standard about market consistent. Very similar change in regime about capital requirements and balance sheets you will find in Denmark, Switzerland, and Holland in particular. So if we take a completely different view about what fair value is in calculating an embedded value, then other people, particularly the analysts, will effectively start making adjustments of their own. So we might as well disclose these numbers and show a bit of leadership. UK actuaries have in the past had a very leading role in these kind of methodologies. So contrary to what one of the other speakers was suggesting about putting ourselves at a disadvantage by disclosure, I think it actually puts companies at a major advantage. There's a very strong argument for providing information about shareholder value that is consistent with local impairment and regulatory capital measures. If you ignore it, then you ignore it at your own risk, at your own peril. I have some other comments about a formulaic approach to the selection of risk discount rates. And I had hoped that the move to a market-consistent embedded value would make some of those arguments disappear, but clearly there are two camps here tonight, and there will be for some time. But if you look about the situation a few years ago, what did we do? Did we use WAC, CAPM, whatever you want to call it? We turned the handle. We seemed to have some sound economic theory, but we applied it out of context. The formulaic approach led to nonsense, and there's a danger of it doing so again. I could go into detail about an example about how risk discount rates were chosen in the past, usually to two decimal places. One thing we have, I hope, learnt over the last few years is that, as one of the other speakers suggested, you can't use risk discount rates found in that way to do option pricing. You only know the right risk discount rate to use if you actually know the answer. So why don't we go straight to the answer? Thank you.
Penny Coulthard and then Jeremy Kent.
Penny Coulthard. Well, I'd like to thank the authors for an excellent summary of where we are with embedded values. I'm sure that we'll all be reaching for this paper a great deal in the future. One area of disclosure required in the CFO Forum principles is the analysis of movement in the embedded value. Whilst an embedded value can be a useful number, it is the movement in the embedded value from one year to the next which provides information on how successfully the company has been run. The analysis of movement in embedded value tells us how profits or losses have arisen, enabling management and shareholders to check that the business is being run in line with their expectations. The new embedded value techniques described in the paper provide us with a clearer understanding of the sources of these profits. For example, within a market-consistent embedded value framework, investment risk is more accurately reflected due to the explicit allowance for options and guarantees. As such, the investment profit or loss is more meaningful and hence more useful. By publishing this investment profit, shareholders will be able to get a clearer insight into the investment risk that they have taken on by investing via an insurance company. But it is not only the investment profit that is more meaningful in a market-consistent embedded value framework. For example, the persistency variance in a with-profits fund will better reflect the impacts of lapse experience on the burn-through cost, as well as on the value of shareholder transfers. This helps management understand the balance between the loss of future shareholder transfers on the one hand and the need for additional capital on the other. Whilst it was possible to calculate these variances under a traditional embedded value framework, the implicit allowance for options and guarantees within the risk discount rate distorted the items of variance and so could give misleading results. For example, the investment profit could be smoothed. The paper seeks to address transparency and consistency in embedded value methodology across companies. In addition, it is important that the analysis of movements in the new embedded values are also consistent and transparent, so that investors and management have a clear understanding of the company's performance.
Stephen Keane. Is Stephen here? And after Stephen, Peter Needleman.
Thank you. Stephen Keane's my name. I'd like to talk about the European embedded value set up with the CFO Forum principles. First thing I'd like to say is that the initiative is very encouraging, and as an example of our industry proactively setting the agenda. It's a common recognition by the key European life insurers of the need to change traditional embedded value disclosure to counter the types of problems the authors have set out in section 2.3. At the heart of the CFO Forum principles is a move to the explicit valuation of the time value of options and guarantees. And as a member of this profession, it doesn't really make sense to me to have to sit down with other finance professionals and to discuss the time value of options and guarantees in any other framework other than a market consistent one. I recognise that the basis is wider than this one element, but I also feel that as a profession we do not need another actuarial value that bears no resemblance to equivalents traded in the market. So the challenge then is that if we plant a flag and say that the time value of options and guarantees are dealt with market consistently, how do we handle the rest of the basis? The answer lies in some form of MCEV, but as the authors point out in section 6.4, this term currently means different things to different people. Having worked with a number of companies who intend to adhere to the EEV guidelines by using market-consistent techniques, it is apparent that this calculation is a workable, transparent one, which would comply with the principles. My final question is what we should call the calculation. Whether you want to call it EEV, European Embedded Value, MCEV, Market Consistent Embedded Value, MCEEV, Market Consistent European Embedded Value, or MEV, Market Embedded Value, I don't think really matters. There's no trademark associated with this work. And testament to this is the three pages of references we find supporting the end of the paper. What I do think is important, though, is that as a profession, we can crack that issue of comparability, not just between two different companies, but also between two different actuaries. And I think market-consistent techniques are a major step in the right direction.
While Peter's making his way to the front, I am reaching the end of my list of people who asked if they could speak, so I will very shortly be throwing it open to anybody who wants to contribute to the discussion.
Thank you. President, ladies and gentlemen, I'd also like to thank the authors for a very helpful and timely paper. The world has moved on since embedded values were introduced, and it's important for the industry and the profession to move on with it. When EV was first introduced, it was a far better measure of profitability and value than either existing accounting or prudential reporting systems. Now both the global accounting profession and the UK insurance regulators have adopted approaches which explicitly use market-consistent techniques to measure complex options and asset risks. Then traditional embedded values, as we know them, have certainly been left behind. So we must welcome moves by the CFO Forum to address the deficiencies in traditional embedded values through the introduction of the European embedded value principles. It's certainly my belief that a market-consistent approach will help inform companies as how to implement EEVs and what allowance to make for risks for different types of business. I'd like to discuss how an MCEV might be expected to relate to a company's actual market value. One school of thought says that if we already know the market value of an insurance company, we should be able to reconcile the MCEV to this. Another says that an MCEV should be calculated independently of the market value, and I would tend to fall into that latter camp. In theory, the difference between an MCEV and a company's market value should be the franchise value of the company, i.e. the value of its ability to write profitable new business in the future. This is an extremely difficult figure to calculate and bound to be subjective. In reality, we're more likely to calculate it by subtracting the MCEV from the actual market value than to be able to calculate it separately as part of any reconciliation. Moreover, with the information available in current EVs, it's hard for analysts and the market generally to work out the market consistent value of the in-force business, let alone the true value of future new business. MC valuation techniques will quite possibly change market perception as they give investors new information on the risks and the cash flows within the business. Therefore, MCEV may inform the market price of insurance companies rather than be driven by them. How do I square the use of a market-consistent embedded value to changing market prices? Well, the key point is that an MCEV is consistent with the price of assets that closely resemble the cash flows in an insurance company. As they're calculated by the company with a far deeper knowledge of what those cash flows are than the market has, so the MCEV can provide a more accurate value of those cash flows. The market price of a company will reflect investors' views of these cash flows, but currently those views may be based on imperfect information. If MCEVs, or indeed EEVs, improve the information available, it should not be a surprise if companies' share prices change to reflect that new information. There has also been some concern that that trade sales recently have been carried out at prices below the embedded value, or indeed the MCEV, and this has raised the question of whether MCEVs are appropriate. There are two important points to make here. Firstly, any market-consistent value reflects the price in a deep and liquid market. This is suitable for reporting, for pricing, and for hedging purposes, but is only the starting point for a sale or an acquisition. A trade sale is not equivalent to a deep and liquid market, and the final price will reflect negotiation between the different parties. The buyer will always want to pay a cheaper price, and the question is whether the seller has pressures that make such a price acceptable. An MCEV just merely represents an appropriate starting point for such a negotiation. The second point I'd make in conclusion is that the price for sales may actually be closer to an MCEV than many imagine. If allowance is made for the various frictional costs, and also if we recognise that the impact of operating assumptions on value is often non-linear, so that in practice it may be necessary to use more prudent operating assumptions to arrive at the best estimate of value, then in fact MCE values may well be closer to traded values than might be apparent at first sight. Thank you.
Richard Badden.
Richard Badden. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank the Working Party for creating a succinct and useful contribution to the rapidly developing area of embedded value reporting. There are two main areas I'd like to address this evening. Firstly, as an M&A practitioner, the majority of my time is spent trying to understand the inner workings of very complex insurance groups without having the benefit of the years of knowledge and experience locked in the heads of the management team. To this end, the introduction of both EEV and MCEV are a godsend. But there is still the major issue of being able to take what is clearly a balance sheet item and transform it into a series of cash flows which can be used for business planning. Perhaps more challengingly, in this brave new world in which we live, is being able to convince bankers and financiers that they should lend money to support an acquisition. The inexorable move towards market consistency makes this increasingly challenging. Whilst the information provided can inform us as to the true costs of guarantees and, if carefully analysed, the distribution, it does make it difficult for us to break down the numbers into a basis which equates clearly to the cash through the income statement. A further concern is the confusion around what these methods actually mean to the investors in the insurance industry. MCEV is the attraction of being able to show that it does fully value all the market risks. However, the other risks embedded in the business have not been fully costed. This is exacerbated by the fact that the traditional view of the world, as presented by EV, and the market-consistent view appear to converge, without there being a clear bridge to unify them. In the M&A context, as previous speakers have mentioned, the market reaction has been, of course, to discount significantly for this uncertainty. My second comment is around the future of financial reporting. It is clear to me that unlike the shortcomings of some insurance accounting systems, both EEV and MCEV seem to avoid the feeling of having the tail wagging the dog. However, it is unclear to me as to whether we have yet achieved the position of having full consistency between the way management teams run their businesses, the way profits are reported, and finally, the way that markets view them. I believe that the increased level of disclosure will certainly help this, but at present does not fully address the issue. If we add to this the introduction of IFRS, the future shape of financial reporting remains uncertain. Perhaps in my own optimistic way, I look forward to the day when we can fully understand the implications of writing a piece of business from the initial stages of pricing through reporting, and finally, and perhaps most importantly, in considering the capital and risk implications of that business in a company's individual capital assessment. It is only then that we can truly believe that we have a consistent reporting system. Thank you.
Simon True.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to add my thanks to the authors for a very timely paper. I'd like to concentrate on just two issues today, two business issues. The practical implications of market-consistent embedded values, or EEVs, whichever route you like to go. And secondly, the volatility of the results. Looking first at the practicalities, there is a concern that's been well voiced that fully market-consistent techniques are just too difficult to calculate. I don't think that's going to wash any further. Many companies have already done it. The paper cites three occasions, and I'm aware of many, many more who have done it for various reasons, as part of a sale or acquisition, pricing, or in just analysing the options open to them in light of the new European embedded value requirements. I think we're agreed that calculating an MCEV is more onerous than the traditional EV, but with the advent of realistic balance sheets and to a lesser extent individual capital assessments, a lot of the tools have been developed and can be utilised within an MCEV framework. Perhaps we're just a little uncomfortable that we might shift our time into understanding the results rather than deliberating on the risk discount rate that gives the answer we wanted in the first place. The second issue is volatility. There is a genuine concern that market-consistent reporting will lead to very volatile results. And this is probably true. But if this volatility indeed reflects the true nature of the business that's been written, what right have we got to hide that fact away from shareholders? Life insurance companies have run significant mismatches in the past, in particular around embedded options and guarantees, duration and credit risk. Any company which does run that mismatch should have volatile results. The way to deal with this is good risk management, not by obfuscating the results. I'd just like to conclude. It does take effort to do this, but it's a short-term pain for a great deal more management insight. Thank you.
Right, I've reached the end of my list of people who notified me in advance who want to speak. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to contribute to the discussion? Yes, one at the back and then one here. Ian. You go, sir. Oops. Senior.
Thank you, President. My name is Richard McVie, and I have the honour of being an honorary fellow of your institute. Just three brief things I'd like to pick up. The focus of the paper, excellent paper, is primarily on the new valuation approach, with some references to the issues relating to financial reporting. But I think in terms of selling this to other professions, which has been commented on, and in particular the accounting profession and the IASB, there are some issues that need specific attention. It seems to me the first of these is the one that Penny raised earlier about the analysis of the change from one year to another. How do we describe the contributors to that performance and how are they analysed? Is, of course, the crucial thing in making this comparable to the kind of profit and loss accounts that people are familiar with from other businesses. And if we think back long enough ago, when I first got interested in all this at the beginning of the 1990s, a lot of that accruals versus embedded value debate was about which method brings out the factors that are driving performance more clearly from a management and investor perspective. The second issue is we don't know where we are with the IASB because at the latest announcement the chairman said we're starting with a clean slate again. But from previous discussions, one particular issue which was raised in IFRS 4 as a tentative conclusion for the next step was basically IASB does not like day one profits. And if your MCEV method produces day one profits, then it's going to have to pass the test which the IASB laid down, which was there has to be very good market evidence. So I think we have to ask what exactly markets are we calibrating to for all the various elements of this embedded value. Some of the markets are clear, the investment markets. Other markets in insurance liabilities, we've always argued, are not deep, liquid and transparent. And so we have to be clear exactly what is being calibrated to and how reliable that is. And then finally, just one thing I've never understood, and maybe somebody one day will tell me the answer, I don't understand this locked-in capital cost. You have some capital, some of it you use in your insurance business, some of it, let us suppose, you have to keep because the regulator says you have to have it. Let's suppose it's all in gilt-edged stock. Why is the value of that gilt-edged stock not the value of the gilt-edged stock? Now you say, oh, that's because of company frictions. In other words, it means investors would rather be having the gilt-edged stock themselves than entrust it to an insurance company investment manager to ruin value for them. Not a very good advertisement for your business. Why do people invest in unit trusts and investment trusts and everything else? Take an investment trust, they stand at discounts to their asset value. They always have done, but nobody's ever suggested that you wouldn't use the market values of the assets in the accounts. You would then address elsewhere, as it were, the price at which the company as a whole trades. So it seemed to me when reading the paper there was some ambiguity about whether the authors did believe in lock-in capital cost or not. As I say, I've never had a sensible explanation of it, so I look forward to hearing one. Thank you.
Hello, Mr. President. I want to speak as... Ian Moran. I'm speaking with as being chairman of the ALG and the Life Accounting Issues Committee. I'm extremely pleased that the Working Party have delivered such a warmly received paper because not that many months ago the committee thought it might be timely, it might be of interest to the profession if we were to talk about embedded values again. And the Working Party has done us proud, and I'm really pleased with the reaction of the audience and the comments I've heard so far. There were three points I wanted to mention regarding the discussions on this topic. And one was mentioned earlier by Peter Niederman. He mentioned the gap between the value of that closed funds have been sold for and the previously reported embedded value, whether that's on a MCEV basis or traditional EV basis. I'm interested in trying to understand a little bit more about what this says about the relevance of the current embedded value or market-consistent embedded value basis. And I think in part it's explained by the willing buyer, willing seller, but I think there's more there, and I think there's an opportunity to learn a little bit more on that topic and see whether we can understand it so we can demonstrate that the values that we produce are relevant to the values of interest to investors. Secondly, there was a good point made by... I missed the name, but about... Well, we're talking about this in the context of a life insurance company, but we're actuaries and we grow up looking at both life, general insurance and pensions through our education. What about the pension scheme? What does it tell us about really what the value issues are there? And I think there's an extension into the pension scheme and to understand the issues and what it tells us about the pension schemes in the life insurance company and maybe broader. And the last point is to just understand how the embedded value, market consistent embedded value approaches link into IFRS, what it tells us in addition to IFRS, and to actually effectively be able to reconcile between the two so that we can then communicate more effectively with investors who will see multiple measures of value. The last point I would make is that we will, the accounting committees will carefully review the comments made tonight, and we're very grateful for the insights made. And if there are any comments that people wish to send, they can either send them to myself or anybody on the live board will be welcome to understand where you think we ought to be exploring a little bit more detail in the future. So thank you.
Any other contributions? Yes?
William Hewitson. I hadn't actually planned to speak tonight, so I'm pleased to hear I'll be quite brief. I was very pleased to hear all the speakers tonight, or almost all the speakers, very much in favour of the market-consistent approach. I think this is indeed the sensible benchmark going forward, even if, as a number of people have said, it's going to be very difficult to accurately assess what is the market-consistent value or some of the longer-term options that exist in many life insurance company liabilities. And, of course, a number of people here have referred to the frictional or agency costs, which could indeed be a significant item in assessing such long-term liabilities. And, of course, part of that might well be the uncertainty that exists both in the models and the underlying parameters. For example, if we are looking at longevity, some people might say, oh, well, that's a diversifiable risk. And, of course, as actuaries, we know full well that we don't know for certain what the best estimate really is of longevity in the longer term, and so there may well indeed need to be some margins for uncertainties that are included in a market-consistent valuation by the use of perhaps the so-called market value margins. But I think this market-consistent approach is indeed going to be the right way forward for us. Thank you.
Any other contributions to our discussion this evening? Yes, please do.
Jeremy Gofford. Excellent paper. And I regard it as a culmination of what we've been seeing maybe over the last 20, 25 years. As long ago as that, we were doing profit tests. And then the miracle happened when we added up profit tests and found it made the company. So that was all very exciting. And then the arguments or discussions started with the accounting profession, and the difference very quickly arose where the accountants were trying to match cost and revenues, and actuaries were essentially balance sheet people. And I think this is the the ground in which we've been debating for the last 10 years or so. And then arguments like, well, why wouldn't you tell the market in your accounts for your financial results in a similar way to the way you were running the company, i.e. if you're running the company using profit testing to price your products, why wouldn't you put the results of those into your results? And these arguments all led to the development of embedded values. Then we had the clash of the titans between the accruals basis and embedded values, and we ended up with a basis where you could use either, which is all very exciting. And so I'm very pleased indeed to see market consistent embedded values and even European embedded values come through as strongly agreed methods. And indeed, very exciting to celebrate the fact that tonight, apart from when I'm going to use these words, we have not heard the words deferred acquisition costs. That devil incarnate. But I think the next moves are, I think, as Penny has pointed out, not just the analysis of movement of embedded value, but also a statement at the beginning of the year by the management and directors how they think the market-consistent embedded value is going to move during the year, and then an analysis, using the analysis of movement of how it has moved against how the management expected it to move, and seeing them justify those variances, and getting down to the drivers of profitability and increase in value, and maybe even identifying those responsible for above expected increase in value and even below expected increase in value. Thank you.
Right, we have time for one more. If there's anybody burning to say a few words. Okay, in that case, I will invite Nigel Masters to close the discussion. Nigel.
Thank you. Thank you, President. Ladies and gentlemen, you'll gather from the great wadge of paper I'm carting around that I took a huge number of notes. Oh, hang on. That sounds like one of those dreaded BlackBerry moments. It keeps going. Stamp on it. It's the best thing for a BlackBerry. Squash fruit. An enormously eloquent contributions tonight and some very meaty points, so you'll excuse me if I don't cover all of the issues that have arisen, but let me pick out a few main themes. And I'll also, if I may, make a few remarks of my own as we go through. A main theme that came out time and again was disclosure. How all of these methods provide the analysts, the readers of the supplementary information, with a great deal more information. I was delighted that our analyst speaker, Rob, tonight managed to do what every analyst in the world has ever done, which is ask for even more. I was even more delighted that he picked up John's offer of only about 2 seconds before and then gave him about three more things he'd like, please, next time. I think I heard John actually agree that he was going to do it as well, near enough. I particularly liked Penny Coulthard's comment as well on the importance of the analysis, and I certainly agree with that. I think the greater analysis is very important. The great debate of the evening has been whether MCEV is the right direction forward, or is market consistency the right way forward. I was quite struck by David Dulloway's comment that, in fact, the implications of the EEV principles, for example, on asset mix, which is a point that I think Nick was worried about, does that imply that the approach should be market consistent? Well, my view is actually it does, because I think if you do start shifting your mix into, say, a lower credit rated bond because you want more yield, I think the impact then is that you actually hold more economic capital. And it's that interplay between the elements of the basis which I think does imply market consistency, or consistency with the market. And somebody made the point that we don't want to go down brand names, and I think that's actually a very important point. I think the interesting thing is that both sides, both MCEV and EEV, are themselves developing with usage. I think probably 18 months ago we had an MCEV which was not comfortable with diversifiable risk having a cost. And I was interested to hear Steve Taylor-Gooby making the point that that is an element that where directionally MCEV may be moving. And I think that that's, that is the kind of movement that will then allow from the other side, the EEV, which has been very concerned with the broad aggregate of risks, maybe to come together. And certainly, I think a greater clarity around frictional costs, as a number of people have said, that's still a developing art, but it is going to continue to develop, I'm sure. As the greater understanding of that comes through, then it may well be that frictional costs and distress costs pull together the costs in the marketplace and the WACC, because after all, the WACC is there to pay for those costs. So I personally believe that this is a time when we can actually bring some of this together rather than be continually looking for new names or more name calling. We don't need to do that. I think one single method has been called for on a number of occasions tonight, and I certainly think I'm aware that, for example, within the CFO forum, there was a very distinct desire to have a single approach because that would improve the presentation to the analysts. And I think that that's one of the drivers for things like getting the cost of guarantees out and transparent. Other areas, certainly in terms of looking at frictional costs, a lot of discussion around that, how that could be moved forward. I think Peter Wright suggested frictional costs should include corporate governance, which I think is a good thought, which I hadn't heard before. And certainly I think over time, separate disclosure perhaps, as Tim Sheldon suggested, would also work for this. So I'm sure with frictional costs it's very much a question of watch this space and see how it develops. Picking up a few key points from Reckon, there was a number of references to accounting and the accounting developments, IFRS and so on, and the work of the ASB. Well, I think there that there's a whole area of difficulty, at least in practical terms, of presenting different approaches to liabilities within supplementary information. One on the EV process, one on perhaps an accounting fair value process. Certainly something like IFRS treatment of pension funds under IAS 19. He looks at Peter and Peter nods, good. And the EEV approach is going to actually be quite close. So do you really want to restate it? And if you do restate it, if it's a very small difference, what, you know, which is going to be the better basis? So we've got elements around that which I think will keep moving as we go forward. And I think it was a call, and I think it was Richard Badden, for perhaps more disclosure or more insight into the cash flow generation which has sat behind EV. And I think, again, that's an area which I've heard voiced by a number of analysts as well, that they were interested in what's the cash flow generation that underpins this. It's a difficult thing to actually try and present. If you think about what is the cash flow underlying the fair value of an optional guarantee under a stochastic model, I mean, how do you actually present that into the marketplace? So some thoughts and developments might be useful there. In terms of usage, I think this is an area which the paper might have explored further. I mean, I was struck by Jeremy Goford's comments just at the end there about EVs were being used internally by management to manage the business. So the analysts wanted to have an insight of how the business was being managed, so they published it. Well, that's a different usage, in my view, and drives you to different approaches than if you're saying, what price can I get for this in the marketplace? And I think Peter Needleman's comments around the use of the various measures, MCEV, EEV, and their impact on franchise value in the situation where you're actually pricing a company, it was useful in that context. There was a call for standards. I think Tim Sheldon used the phrase the need for rigour. And I think there was perhaps also a call, and I apologise, I haven't made a note of the speaker, but a call for perhaps not more guidance, not more wider guidance around EV, but that some guidance around UK products. That might have been Paul Collins. I apologise if it wasn't. But Paul did make a very good point that of a need to work with the ABI. We have two representatives in the front row, and no doubt we'll bend their ears afterwards over drinks or something about how we can work with them. I think that's desperately important to... because as a number of people have said, this is not necessarily an actuarial decision in the end. This is for the directors of companies relating to their analysts, or relating perhaps to the buying and selling of a company. So to that extent, the actuaries are part of facilitating the management information. I'd just like to thank Steve Taylor-Gooby for the insights that he brought on particularly on the discussion around the setting of a WACC rate. I thought that was helpful, and even more helpful, Steve, was the thought of some more work for the working party. I'm sure they're always keen for new members. And I'm sure that you could contribute a bucket load. Okie doke, that's Steve stitched up for another working party. Perhaps if I might pick up one last speaker, President, and that was Richard McVeigh, and the very useful sort of commentary, perhaps... I happen to be a convert to locking in capital, and I think that capital does get eroded in some way, shape or form if it's put at risk. On the other hand, the comparison with unit trusts I thought was useful, and maybe that's something we should look at. Not least, I think, because an item that wasn't touched on within EEV, but which I consider is going to be very important over the next couple of years, is the expansion of the business cupboard away from simply the life business to things like the asset managers, to the locked-in pension values, and to the healthcare companies. And very happy to see one of our official guests here with exactly that interest, I hope, I'm sure. Mr. President, there's a whole load of detailed comments which I've missed out, and I apologise to the speakers for that. But perhaps I can make my closing remarks to the authors of the paper. I think that this is a super paper. I found it remarkably easy to get through it. I was, as is the usual way of these things, with about 2 days to go before it actually had to go to the printers, I was being... I still hadn't quite got round to making my last comments, I have to say I read this at high speed and found it extremely easy reading, and I would certainly recommend it to all, and I commend them for their very balanced view on a difficult subject. So thanks to them. Thank you, President.
Thank you, Nigel. I'll now ask Neil Taverner to respond to the discussion on behalf of the authors.
Thank you, Mr. President. I should start by mentioning that these remarks are my own conclusions from the discussions this evening and therefore may not reflect the views of the working group as a whole, but I'm sure they'll correct me in any written contributions later if I misrepresent them. I'd like to thank everyone who contributed to the discussion this evening. As with our session at the Life Convention in Edinburgh, it's been very valuable to hear the views of a wide range of actuaries on this topic. Several contributors raised the question of what the profession's next step should be in respect of actuaries' contributions to embedded values. We didn't make any concrete recommendations on this in the paper, largely because we didn't want the paper to be exposed to the profession and discussed by it this evening before any such steps were considered by the working group, the working party itself, or by the Life Board. However, as Mr. Collins and several others mentioned, we did feel that it was not necessarily the profession's role to be proposing a whole new set of guidance or requirements for embedded value calculation and disclosure, for various reasons which several contributors elaborated on. The CFO Forum framework itself seems to us to contain all of the basic elements which are required by an embedded value calculation and disclosure regime. And as we mentioned in the paper, there isn't really any reason why it shouldn't be completely adequate, provided that the allowances for risk that are made, in a combination of the discount rate, the locked-in capital, and the costs of options and guarantees, are indeed a sufficient allowance for risk, as the principles require. The basic approach of the CFO Forum framework, I think, does have the advantage of familiarity, and therefore ease of explanation. However, I think the potential danger with it, as several contributors mentioned this evening, is that the allowance for risk which is made in those three areas does remain somewhat opaque and may still vary from one company to another. I think it's certainly our view, and it seems to be the view of several contributors this evening, that this is perhaps the key area where actuaries, both individually and as a profession, do, I think, have a particular role to play. We are a profession whose role is to assess and to communicate risk, and therefore ensuring that risk has been adequately assessed in whatever methodology is used to calculate an embedded value and clearly communicated to the users of that information is therefore of fundamental importance to the profession, I think, and that came through very clearly in the discussions this evening. So the aim of our coverage of the developing techniques in market consistent and frictional cost type methodologies was really to highlight the many new tools which we have as a profession, or which we could have very shortly, to analyse and to value risk from a shareholder perspective. We do think that a market-consistent approach to valuing market risk itself is at the very least a vital benchmark in checking whether a disclosed embedded value makes adequate allowance for such market risks. And as several contributors, notably Mr. Morgan and Mr. Dulloway, mentioned, it's difficult to see how you can justify a disclosed embedded value which is higher than a pure market-consistent value, except perhaps in extremely unusual circumstances. If we move on from looking at pure market risk and onto diversifiable risk, I think it's true to say, I think Steve Taylor-Gooby mentioned this quite clearly, for many companies it may well be the market risks which will dominate in terms of the impact on shareholder value. However, diversifiable risks do affect shareholder value, we think, in many ways, notably via frictional costs. And the emerging techniques which we touched on in the paper and which have been discussed again this evening to at least approximately assess frictional costs on the impact of frictional costs on shareholder value should really, I think, form part of the reasonableness check which actuaries should be making on the allowance for risk in any disclosed embedded value. I think several contributors agreed with us and others were slightly more bullish than we are as to the state of development of the assessment of frictional costs. However, I would agree with Mr. Taylor Gooby that for many companies, the impact of diversifiable risks and frictional costs on shareholder value may be quite small in comparison with the impact of market-related risks for some companies. However, I think there may well be other types of company where that's not the case, and I think it's important to understand which companies are which if we're to ensure that sufficient allowance has been made for risk in whatever methodology has been used to communicate shareholder value to shareholders. I'd agree with John Heal, I think, raised the point that frictional costs may be quite adequately reflected, in fact, by cost of capital, if the required capital which is locked in is actually based on an economic or risk-based capital model. I think that's quite likely to be the case, but it probably should be checked within some sort of stochastic model, which I think companies are starting to think about building, stochastic models which would incorporate not only market-related risk, but non-market-related risks, in terms of assessing their impact on shareholder cash flows and frictional costs, perhaps leveraging off the sorts of models which companies are building for risk-based capital and ICA-type calculations. In terms of potential criticisms of market-consistent and frictional costs, there were a few contributors this evening who did agree with the implication in the paper that it may not quite yet be fully developed enough to be robustly and consistently applied by all companies, and I think in particular also to be understood by management and easily communicated to the markets. However, I think we did think that as a framework for calibrating the allowances for risk in whatever approach is actually used in the actual communication to management or investors, to whatever degree of precision is possible or desirable, then it seems to us to be already a very useful framework and likely to become even more so. I think just to conclude, several speakers mentioned that, particularly here in the UK and as a profession, we are rapidly becoming very skilled at applying market-consistent and risk assessment-type techniques to regulatory balance sheets, and it would seem, I think, very strange not to use these techniques to assess shareholder value. Where such items, for example, as the cost of financial options and guarantees are being assessed on a market-consistent basis for the regulator, then disclosing them on a different basis to shareholders seems to me to be an excellent example of the sort of information imbalance which between insurance companies' management and their shareholders, which are quite often used to justify the existence of agency costs. So just to close, I think, just to summarise, I think the view of the meeting tonight as well, I think that as market-consistent and frictional cost-type techniques do move further to the forefront, whether it's via accounting-type developments such as FRS 27 or risk-based capital-type developments such as Solvency II, embedded value reporting will certainly need to keep up with those, and I would agree with many contributors this evening that the profession should certainly be at the forefront of this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. Well, I think you'll all agree we've had not only a very practical paper from the authors, but also a highly, highly productive and interesting discussion this evening. And I think that together has combined to give us all an excellent meeting here tonight. So I would like to ask you to join me in thanking the authors, the opener, the closer, and all those who participated in this evening's discussion. It would be very helpful if those of you who did speak and who have some prepared notes could hand a copy of them to either Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons as you leave the hall this evening. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday the 4th of April, and a discussion on the modelling of extreme events is scheduled to take place. You're now warmly invited to continue the discussions and join us in a glass of wine in the council chamber at the back there. And if I could ask those of you who are sitting in the council chamber at the back, if you could help by moving some of the chairs out of the way, that would be very helpful. I declare the meeting closed.